Hi, welcome back. Sabrina George, still on New Comedy Radio, interviewing Henning Venn, part two.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag. Now, the next bit is not where do you get material from, but what sort of ideas, because originally you were saying you took old jokes and just translated them and deconstructed them. Where do you get your stuff now from? As you have developed.
I think the main source of material really is, I mean, I try to move more and more into social commentary. So that is the way my act developed. And I get lots of material from the newspapers, really. I read papers every day, and that is my main source of inspiration.
Because your stuff the last year, from what I've seen, is moving quite interestingly towards, I'll use the dreaded word, racism. And dealing with the accusations made that you're racist.
Who makes such accusations?
I remember I did. We had a heated discussion about 2 years ago. And I said, you just can't do that. And you said, I can talk about anything. That's the whole point of stand-up. I can talk about anything. And I saw you starting to, and other people, probably wasn't me, other people seemed to be saying the same thing. And your responses to that in your material, I thought, were really interesting.
What was my response? What is my response? I mean, I say everybody has got the God-given right to be on the receiving end of racial insults. So, and therefore, I mean, it's no good excluding certain groups. I mean, everybody should have the honour to be dealt with in stand-up. So yeah, it's not really... I mean, there is certain topics I feel uncomfortable with, but then it's always that is... like, for example, I must say, I am a hypocrite as well, because I wouldn't really feel comfortable making jokes about handicapped people. So, that would be something I would feel uncomfortable with.
Why?
Yeah, it has got to do with the fact that that you think, oh, they're already so hard done by life, you can't do that on them. So that is obviously totally wrong. So because that really leads to a social exclusion. So and I'm ashamed of myself. So and I promise you, I will write more material about handicapped people.
So they can be included.
Yeah.
But you don't feel that about a minority that's been having a tough time in society.
I've got a hard time 24/7. So no, I don't feel that at all.
You don't feel that?
No, because we're all the same. We're all human beings. So, and I don't have that concept of differentiating between how you're from China and you're from India and you're from England and you're from Poland. So, I mean, for me, it's all human beings. So, and that makes everybody the target, and everybody should be included and should be acceptable to make fun of them.
My impression is that you've done a very interesting sort of curve ball on this, is that in your set, is that you say that and you're not really actually targeting them at all.
Yeah, because I mean, and the funny thing is always whatever you do is, let's put it blunt, if you would make a joke about, let's say, a black person, you stand a good chance that there will be people complaining, but I can guarantee you it will not be a single black person complaining, it will be all the other people complaining on behalf of whoever was targeted. Even though the person that was targeted or the ethnic background, they take it into account.
But I've never heard you do that. I've never heard you target any particular ethnic background. I've heard you you sort of say you're going to and you don't, and then you justify why you should, but you don't actually do it.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, there is certain elements that you can make people feel uncomfortable.
Yes.
So, for example, I've got a bit of material where I talk about the Chinese, so, and where then say, how is it possible that they are regarded as an ethnic minority? So it's so many of them, so 1.3 billion. So they say, yeah, and that is so patronizing from the West to go out and say, oh yeah, you little Chinese, you are an ethnic minority. I mean, how dare we?
But I think it's also something that the Brits used to do, be past masters of, for being racist. We were the best at it. We were absolutely, you know, full-on racist for, I think, really up until the early mid-80s. And we had this massive swing around. And now some people are very confused about what is racism and what isn't. And I think it's very clear that anything that targets somebody who has no defence against that, to me, is unacceptable. Mm. But if they've gotten a defence against it, then I think that's acceptable. So, you know, I think, you know...
Yeah, but then still you decide whether they've got a defence or not. So you're acting on their behalf.
Yeah, and I think that discrimination is up to the individual as to what that means. But that's how I understand it in my head. If I'm in a British National Party thing and there's one black person and I decide to do a whole series of anti-black jokes, I would say it's pretty clear that person really has got much of a defence in that particular context. That's pretty clear.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're with a sort of in a very liberal environment and maybe half the audience are black and half the audience are white, you're going to feel that there's a slightly... I don't happen to have any black jokes, but I think that just a little bit of intelligence, you can work that out. But some people just can't work that out at all, so they just get frightened, feared off the whole thing and just pull off everything.
Mm. Because that's a good point. Well, I wasn't aware that you're doing corporates for the BNP, though.
Oh, every night.
Every night.
They're the best payers. Nobody else will touch them. And it's the same with sort of handicapped people, because I have done some gigs where there's been handicapped people in the audience, and it's really interesting to try, even just by looking at them, you can include them massively. And some people just can't; they freak out. They won't even look at them when they're talking to them. You know, when I'm emceeing, particularly, you're talking to people, to deliberately leave out the one person in a wheelchair or one person with a, you know, who's obviously blind or something, is in a way just as bad.
I remember what was very fun was at a comedy gig, and Al Pitcher done his set, and it was quite an oddly shy room because there was loads of paper at the side, but it was very small in front of the stage. And so in front of the stage, there were then about 6 or 7 wheelchairs. And that was basically, if you stood on stage and looked straight, all you could see was 6 or 7 people in a wheelchair. And so then one of them, I don't know what the illness is, but so was making all sorts of noises as well, very loudly. So, and then I remember Al standing on stage and said, "What are you getting so excited about?" No, and then obviously because everybody felt so uncomfortable, basically that was his set done, so then he could only do his time and go off. And so, but that was, I mean, that was for him such a tricky one to decide what to do, because, I mean, it was, everybody could hear it, so, and he totally lost his focus because it was,
whatever, some sort of noise, yeah.
Yeah, some sort of really loud
random
noise.
Noises,
random
yeah.
noise. And that was the only thing he could see anyway.
Yeah.
And he said, "What are you getting so excited about?"
Because that,
and it's a tricky one, how to deal with that.
Well, that's why I think I decide ahead of time that, you know, what would happen to... What, and this is again why you do so many gigs, because the more gigs you do, the more you'll come across the unexpected initially, and the second time it won't be unexpected. But for me, what I do is I make a decision ahead of time that if I hear someone making random noises, assume that there's something going on there, and then try and be the voice of the audience asking what's going on.
Yeah.
And then once it's been addressed and the whole audience knows, and you know, and the comics know, then generally everybody forgets about it. But it's like, if nobody says anything, it becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger question mark hanging over the auditorium.
You have to address it somehow.
And it's assuming that if they're in the room that they can speak English, even though they can understand English, but they might not be able to speak it. But then you can actually say, you know, just nod or something. but just turn it back on itself so that the whole audience then relaxes and
and
knows that that's what the deal is, and hopefully knows that that person is there because they're really enjoying themselves. But I've seen that in the theatre a couple of times where the cerebral palsy is something, often one of the ones where people have this random laugh and it's very, very noisy. And sometimes it, you know, it'll just go on and on and on when it doesn't seem like it's appropriate. And I've seen it in the theatre where actors have just said, "Will you fucking shut up?" And there's this one person having a brilliant time. But, you know, usually only the local audience know about it. The rest of the audience don't know. They just think there's some drunk in the back. Why aren't they thrown out? Whereas if you actually stay, then generally people are very, very amenable. If they know what it is. That's my take on it, is that, you know, or just somebody being weird, you know, the classic, the arm missing, or, you know, why don't you, what was it, there was one guy, I remember this comic telling me the story about some guy who was twitching and fidgeting with his hands under the table, and the guy said, "Will you put your hands on the table and stop wanking," or something like that, you know, one of those classic jokes that isn't, and eventually the person next to him said he hasn't got any arms. And it was just like the comic could only see this, and this person was moving on like this, and they just didn't have any arms to put on the table, but this comic kept, or the MC, whoever it was, kept on saying, "Put your arms on the table or stop fidgeting onto it." Didn't have any.
Then basically that gig was over then, wasn't it?
I think for that person, but I think a clever comic would have come on and said, you know, addressed it in some other way and actually brought the person into the gag somehow. To me, I would say that's possibly my answer to things like racism, bring them into the gag. It just goes on, just flashing lights on the recorder. So what's your, 'cause last year you did one World Pope, four World Cups.
Four World Cups and one World Pope. Yeah.
One World Pope, yeah. What's going to happen next? Which actually wasn't very much about the Pope or the World Cup.
That was a brilliant marketing.
because that was quite interesting, because you've teamed up quite a lot in various different formats with your lovely mate Otto, who's very German, lederhose wearing, umpsy bumpsy type humour.
I mean, he's great, Otto Kuhnle, and absolutely honoured that he works with me. So.
Hugely famous in Germany.
Yeah, so...
Gradually getting to be known here.
Yes, so, and he really wouldn't need to work with me, but he's famous and easy way into the British market, and, for me, it's superb because I learned so many things.
How did that happen?
That was really a chance... Also done a gig in Germany when it was a British comic, so, and was also a small promoter, Brian Damage. So, and then Otto said, "I'll tell you what," he said to Brian, "I'll come to London visit you." And then he went over to London, visited him, so, and I went to his club just to have a drink. So, and then I got introduced to Otto, so, and I knew him anyway. So, I.
By reputation.
So then I said, "Okay, let's go tomorrow. If you've got nothing on, let's go tomorrow. Let's go to the London Eye and sing some German folk songs, and let's see how that goes down." So, and then we did that, went very well.
What way did it go very well? Or did you just stood there with their mouths open?
Yeah, and lots of people queuing and taking photos, and nobody giving any money. But we immediately realised that there is some energy that we can definitely use, and then came up to the Edinburgh Festival, where I was in a compilation show from Hackney Empire, so he came up for a few days. That was in 2005, and worked very well. We even got a couple of black tie dinners out of it to play, and so then we said, yeah, we'll really build on that. So then last year, 2006, was the first time that we done the Edinburgh Festival together. And then after that, 2 weeks in London in the New End Theatre, and I mean, the difference is one person makes it. If I perform on my own, it's performance, but if Otto is there, it turns into an event because it's two Germans, and just it's a great package.
And you both play at the Stereotype. Because he wears lederhosen and that funny hat, whatever it's called, that little feather in.
Yeah, but the thing is, he would do the same stuff in Germany. So that is, I mean, because, I mean, in Germany nobody wears lederhosen. So then you, if somebody goes on stage wearing lederhosen, that's funny. So in Germany, that is funny.
So when you say he taught you lots of things, what, in what way and what sort of things has he taught you?
I mean, he made me a lot, hell of a lot of better stand-up just by giving me advice. And I mean, he has been around in Germany selling out theatres under his own name for the last 25, 30 years. And so with all that experience he has got, for example, we've done the New End theatre. And the lighting wasn't right, the stage wasn't at all for us because we followed a play that was on earlier. So, and we didn't know what to make with it. I on my own would have been totally lost. So, and then Otto said, okay, we have a light check. So, and then he within an hour and a half, he'd written them the perfect cues for the light. So, and the lighting was brilliant. So that's, for example, something I could have never ever done on my own. And that's the sort of experience that he has got on all levels. So, and
so how did he help you direct with your stand-up itself?
By saying one thing, for example, I became a bit of a habit of repeating myself before the punchline. So I said the setup twice before punchline. And he's saying that sounds like if you wouldn't be all there, so just cut that out. So now I tried that. And I say really, because he said then you'll get a lot more material in and it will all be a lot more fluent. And it turns out he's right.
Because his English is very minimal, and it's got a bit better, but his English is still not so... But he understands your material.
Yeah, that is, he understands my material, and I mean, that is just one of the basics. He says try to perform it differently, so you don't really need to understand exactly what he said. It's just if there is a certain pattern that you find that doesn't sound quite right. So when he has got the hearing, then he said, it does not sound quite right, try it slightly different. So, and that's all sort of... that's all brilliant advice, and in how to structure a show, for example. So with the changes going on and off, and how to make it, because if we do a show together, so then he's on, I'm on, he's on, I'm on, very briefly on together. So, but he says then even during the bits, it's important when we're not together on stage that there is still some line that all holds it together. So like if that is one prop that's used by both, like for example in our case a broom, we both use broom as a prop, and it's things like that, so the directing aspect of it as well. So he's an expert in all those fields, so and that makes
so how makes did you structure your show for Edinburgh with him then? What was the process that got you to work in that structure?
Yeah, I mean, we both said what we don't want to do. We said the one person goes on, bangs out 25 minutes, then the next person comes on, bangs out 25 minutes. That we didn't want. Then we said, okay, what can we do together? What can we do together? Sing German folk songs. So, say, okay, we put that on the end. It's a nice end anyway. What is the tricky thing if you do a gig? You really have to get the audience on your side first of all. Can you do that any easier than by playing an instrument? So the thing is, Otto walks on first, does 2 minutes his own song, so hello, hello, then everybody is really going for it, then he brings me on, so from there it's already very easy. So and then we've done one more change when only he was on, and he brought me back on, so I don't know anybody wants to listen to this, but so, and then in the end it finished with us both being on stage together. So it's quite, I mean, it's not rocket science, but it is
quite a challenge to go from a 20-minute set to an hour show. Or don't you think so?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. I mean, I've done a couple of 1-hour shows on my own, and Yeah, definitely. It's a step that you... It's especially a step in... Well, we have to, because you can't be full on for 60 minutes. You couldn't go jog, because people would be tired out. And therefore you need to get the hang of... You have to be boring every now and then to be interesting again. So and that's the thing, you have to really play well in an hour show, I think. That you know when to be boring.
It's getting the flow right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that you know when to be boring, so that just so to become interesting again. So that is that flow, that's the key thing, I think.
Because you have got a mixture of sometimes almost storytelling to just doing one-line gags. You do move between those spectrums. You don't just do gags.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, then with an hour show, I mean, just talking about Edinburgh, what I think is important is if you go there with your first one-hour show, there's a lot of comics doing that. They build up for 4 years or something and put their best material in. They've got a great hour. Do that, Edinburgh works very well, so that people say, oh yeah, that was quite good, I would like to see him again. So then they come back next year, and then all of a sudden they don't have 4 years to write it, they only have got 1 year to write it. So and then to follow that up, that's the hard bit. So therefore I personally think should only go do an hour show, let's say in Edinburgh, only if you already know what your hour show the year after will be. So that's my personal point. So that the product is strong enough that even at the second time the people that you won in the first run, that they'll come back and then say, wow, that's another hour and that was very good as well.
And build it up. So have you got an idea for your show next year?
In 07 or 08?
07.
Yeah, I'll do again. Show was Oxford.
I'm just going to stop there for part. End of part.
Yeah, nobody wants to listen to that, isn't it? That's just...
No, we do.